Welcome to Community Conversations. These are pre-recorded interviews brought to you each Tuesday and Thursday at 8 a.m. on KRFY. Because of ongoing concerns about the COVID pandemic, we are not able to be in the studio doing live broadcast interviews right now. But we are still dedicated to recording and bringing to you topics of local and current interest, highlighting voices from our community. For Community Conversations, we are using phones and web-based technology so that participants can be recorded remotely. Please bear with us if there are any gaps or hiccups that might be caused by a slow or unstable phone or internet connection. Also, keep in mind that because these interviews are recorded, information may change between the time of this recording and the time that you hear it broadcast. Thank you for joining us for today's Community Conversation on KRFY 88.5 FM, listener-supported community radio for North Idaho. Good morning and welcome to the Tuesday edition of Community Conversations. This program will air towards the end of April. We are recording it a few days ahead of time. I don't think much will change with today's topic in between, but do check the podcast if you miss anything. And I'd like to welcome again everybody to the Tuesday morning Community Conversation with Phil Huff and my co-host Julie Calamine. Good morning, Julie.
Well, hello, Phil. How are you doing?
Very good. How are you doing?
Just fine. Summer is arriving. We've got spring blooms, and I just feel like summer is about around the corner.
Well, I know. Everything's starting to bud out. It's really nice.
Yes, it is. And this is one of the shows where we're going to butt out a little, Phil, no pun intended. We have a special guest. As our listeners know, we often cover topics related to the environment, outdoors, education-related things. But today is a little bit different for us because upcoming month is Mental Health Awareness Month. And we have special guests who are going to talk about one of the issues that relates to mental health, and that is the topic and the problem of addiction in the community. And with that, I would like to introduce Dr. Bob Rust and a patient and I think a friend, Allison. Hello, Dr. Bob.
Good morning.
Good morning, and hello, Allison.
Good morning.
Yes, so I got to know Dr. Rust through recreational activities, but I know that he began as a general practitioner here in the area and retired and then unretired because you came to work with a addiction program, a medical assist addiction, which you'll tell us more about. It's a Suboxone or buprenorphine program, and Allison has been part of that. And today we're going to listen to them and hear their stories and then also hear what Dr. Rust has done and Allison's success, and then also a little more generally about addiction, how to help folks that may be encountering that you know or maybe think are in need of help, how best to do that. Dr. Bob, is there any other introduction I need to give, or do you want to just go ahead and take it away?
I'll take it away. I'm fine. Thank you. Basically, my own personal introduction is what I've done for the high school classes that I did. And we're going to start with a paper called What is Addiction? To get people introduced to that concept. And basically, when I was young, all my family had a problem, which is part of why I'm doing this. I got started as when buprenorphine became available around the year 2000. I got started knowing about it, and then I had a few patients get addicted to their pain medicine as a family doctor. And my mom and my brother both died of their addiction, mainly of cigarettes, but they also had addiction to alcohol, my brother drugs. And so it just seemed like a natural for me when I went to retire 10 years ago from family practice. I became board certified in addiction medicine, which I'd already been doing it for about 4 or 5 years in my office. And I've had a lot of fun with my career, and I'll be retiring. So addiction, or I became addicted to cigarettes when I was in college. All my family smoked. And so it's really helped me to be able to advise people, having been addicted myself to something. Fortunately, I missed the alcohol and the drugs of the other people in my family. And mainly, my mom's side of the family was the difficult one. Almost everybody, her and her brothers and sisters and everybody on her side of the family had addiction problems. Now, actually, I'm dealing with my brother's son, my nephew, and they're calling me, asking me, hey, this guy has a problem, what are we going to do about it? And, you know, being able to help them and our family with their issues has been just another opportunity to help people understand this disease. Basically, addicts are real people, and they're good people, like my mom and my brother, all good people, but they were saddled with a bad disease. Now we try to call addiction opiate use disorder or alcohol use disorder. Even addiction is a derogatory term. You know, the old terms, hook, slang, having a monkey on your back, a pothead, a druggie, an alkie, or some other derogatory terms. We're trying to get rid of those in our vocabulary. I don't think we'll ever get rid of the word addiction, but we are trying to reduce the stigma when we use words. So addiction is a compulsive drive. We're going to talk about this first, the compulsive drive to take a drug or repeat a behavior like gambling or sexual addiction, despite serious adverse consequences that occur as a result of this compulsive drive. There are diagnostic criteria for addiction in the book, and now we have criteria for all different drugs, stimulants like methamphetamine and cocaine, alcohol, opiates, and we call it mild, moderate, or severe. And so we call it an alcohol use disorder, mild, moderate, or severe, and that's how we label our patients. At any rate, there are 11 criteria, development of tolerance, withdrawal, used in greater amounts than longer than needed, unsuccessful attempts to cut down or stop, much time spent obtaining, using, important activities reduced or given up. But number 7 here on the list really tells it all. Continued use despite knowledge of physical or psychological harm. So you know it causes harm and you keep doing it because you have this incredible desire to do so. Craving, failure to fulfill major role obligations, homework or school, continued use despite persistent social or interpersonal problems, like trouble with your family or your wife, continued use despite awareness of the physical hazards. So out of 30 million substances, there are only a few that are actually addictive, of about 100 chemical substances, surprisingly few. And the most addictive substance is the one that causes the most havoc in standpoint society, nicotine. Tobacco, chewing tobacco, lead to serious diseases, lung cancer, emphysema, and really that continues to be the most serious problem in our community. If you use nicotine, about 34% of any time users ever use, smoked a cigarette, get addicted. That's how addicting the nicotine is. It's an astonishing figure. For heroin, the figure is 23%, alcohol 15%. For marijuana, it's 9%, but if you're an adolescent, it's 17%, a lot higher chance of getting addicted. These chemicals are rewarding, they're reinforcing, and they're very pleasurable. They reduce stress in your life temporarily, but in the long run, they cause problems. They increase dopamine in your brain and they activate the brain reward system more powerfully than natural rewards. And those natural rewards are food and sex. Micro injections in animals leads to repeated self-administration of drugs, even in favor of food or water. behavioral addictions like gambling, internet, sex cause similar chemical rewards. The reward-driven use leads to habitual use and eventually compulsive use, persistent vulnerability. So what causes this? Well, we don't get to pick our genetics, but that's the basic underlying cause. Almost always, it's in your family. If you have addiction, there are many other families that have handed it down to you. Then combine that with environmental factors, exposure, availability, novelty seeking in adolescence, coexisting mental illness, social stress, antisocial contact, corporal support. No group is immune from addiction, rich or poor, educated or illiterate, professional or blue collar. If your close relatives have addiction problems, you are at a much greater risk. So chemical dependency does not necessarily mean addiction. Most people who use opiate drugs for cancer or non-cancer pain have tolerance and withdrawal, but they don't have all the other addiction behaviors we just talked about. Only 5% of those folks develop addiction. Pain actually significantly reduces the risk of addiction. If you're taking medicine for pain, you don't have nearly the risk of becoming addicted that you would if you're just playing around with drugs. If you have a real reason for using them, you have a lot less risk. Substance use disorder is the deal. It's the new term. It's what we try to do because addiction, you know, pegs people to be bad people. And people with disease or anybody in our society, they're not bad people. They're people that have a family history, like my family history. My mom, my brother, all of her relatives, her brothers and sisters had addiction problems. It's very similar to diabetes. Diabetes is a long, lifelong disease, requires daily management. This is a lifelong disease. It requires daily management. And people don't take care of their disease. Having the disease is not your fault. People need to understand that. It's very important. It's not your fault you got this disease. But now that you have it, you need to take care of it. And we'll talk about that a little bit. The patient is responsible for getting into a state of quote, unquote, recovery, the state of non-use of all addictive drugs. Now, it's really hard for people to understand how much power the drugs have on you. Well, why don't they just stop it? You know, they can control us. But the strength and controlling power of addictive craving is very difficult to understand if you have never been exposed to it. Many of us who have been addicted to cigarettes can appreciate and be empathetic to addicted patients because we know how hard it is to stop once you start. Many of us have been addicted to cigarettes. You know, for me, it was the hardest thing I ever did in my whole life was quit smoking. Very difficult to do. And I didn't have people to guide me either. It was just on my own. I smoked when I was in college and medical school. And after 5 years, I was packing half a day. So the urges to use are stronger than the urge to go pee when you have to get full bladder. So you're in a car and you're going down the freeway and you got to hold it back and whoever is driving doesn't want to stop, but your body demands that you do something. Now, resistance to the urge, just like to go to the bathroom, is just like the resistance to the urge to use the drugs. It's very similar. You got to do something you got to do now. When you go to the bathroom, wow, that feels good. Relief. And so it's very rewarding and similar to the relief felt by the addict after using. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to introduce Allison. Allison has been a patient taking buprenorphine for 14, 15 years with me. And she was came out of a middle-class family. Well, let me let her tell the story.
Well, you know, I think it's really important that my story gets out there. You know, it's a little bit of a shocking story, and it's not always a story that I like to rehash, but it's important for people to hear it because people need to know that this literally can happen to anybody and things can get out of control really fast. And it's really never intended that way. And it can really ruin your life. And I'm really lucky that I'm sitting here today and that I'm not dead or in jail. I got really lucky. And then of course I met Dr. Rust and everything changed for me. And this is the most normal I've ever been. I mean, what normal might be, things in my life are really good now. You know, I've been married for many years. I have two kids. I own a home. We have a small business.
Two college degrees.
Yes. And, none of this would have been possible had I kept doing what I was doing. So again, I'm really lucky to have met Dr. Rust, and I'm really proud that I've worked as hard as I have all these years. So I grew up in a small town in Montana, not quite this small, but small enough. And I grew up in a really normal family, upper middle class. Should have had a happy childhood, but I can't really say that I did. You know, I was kind of a isolated child. You know, I was kind of the fat girl, the sad fat girl, didn't have a lot of friends. Yeah. And so.
For you guys hearing laughing, I was pointing at myself and mouthing, that was me. Yeah. Fat isolated girl, but go on. Sorry to interrupt.
So yeah, I suffered depression at a very young age. I would say by the time I was 8 or 9, I was clinically depressed. I felt crappy about myself. And I never really had any friends. And then, you know, of course, as you know, I got into, you know, hitting puberty and, you know, becoming a teenager, I really, really wanted to be part of that. I really wanted friends and I wanted things to be exciting. And so I started hanging out with kids that, you know, would be my friend. And of course, those were not the kids that my parents wanted me to hang out with. You know, and so I started doing things like smoking and drinking, and, you know, it made me cool. And I loved that feeling. I loved that feeling of having friends and people thinking I was cool. And so I kind of ran with it. And then before long, you know, then I was, you know, smoking marijuana. And by the time I was in high school, by the time I was a senior, I was doing some pretty hard drugs, drugs that most kids back then didn't even know what they were, things like meth and coke. And I was on my way to addiction pretty well by the time I was, you know, 16 or 17. I was able enough to stay out of trouble, thank goodness, but I was also very good at lying and hiding it. And that's another kind of primary addiction when you're an addict, is one of your addictions when you're an addict is lying. You get really good at it. So I graduated high school and I went to college and kept using drugs. I found out that, wow, I could study and stay up all night if I did a lot of drugs. And that's how I was getting my good grades. You know, people were really impressed with me. They're like, wow, you know, you work full-time and you're a full-time student, you're getting really good grades. This is amazing. How do you do it? And, you know, they had no idea what I was really up to. You know, nobody knew I was staying up all night on hard drugs so I could get my homework done. Well, one day, how I got onto the even heavier stuff was I really needed to sleep. And somebody said, oh, well, here, take one of these. And I think it was hydrocodone. It was, you know, an opiate, you know, pain medication. And it absolutely helped me sleep. And then I kind of got into this really, you know, bad cycle of staying up with drugs and then going to sleep with drugs. And I found myself being addicted to several different substances at once. And then things kind of progressed from there, and I ended up being introduced to heroin. And then that's when things just really fell apart. Heroin isn't a drug that you want to mess around with. You get addicted really fast, and it takes over your life really fast.
One of the things I remember her saying is, I never felt so good. I want to feel like this my whole life after I used heroin.
Yeah, the first time that I used heroin, that was what I thought. I thought, oh my God, I want to feel like this every day for the rest of my life.
So the question I have at this point, I think most listeners would hear heroin and connect in their heads its usage being one that's mostly with addicts. And opioids certainly has been front and center of the addiction conversation the last few years. And yet there's a whole array of legal and valid uses for opioids over the years. And so where and how, and maybe I would direct this first to Dr. Russ, do we come to understand when the legitimate use then becomes the property of the addict? I'm not sure if I'm expressing that right, but where's that line? How do you know when?
Well, in the late 1900s, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, opiates were widely available and not controlled. And eventually what happened is that their use got out of control, and then there was a Harrison Act made in 1914. And that Harrison Act led to much stricter control. And later other acts also were involved where the FDA controlled the medical use of medication. So the medical use was very important to help people with pain, break a leg or whatever. It was very useful. People in war used it for used morphine, and in World War II, methadone was invented by the Germans, actually. And it was a great medication when you had your leg blasted off, and it made you somewhat reasonably comfortable. So they were very important in terms of helping humanity reduce suffering. And so then recent problems with oxycodone and OxyContin, Purdue was heavy into the marketing of OxyContin. Now, one of the things that people said was, well, all the doctors are starting this, by prescribing. Now, we did change, and of course, I've been in medical school since 67. In 67, we thought drugs were something the doctor would control, and then everybody would use the medications exactly as they were prescribed, but obviously that didn't happen. However, doctors in treating pain was not the primary cause of people becoming addicts. Street drugs like heroin and now mixed with fentanyl is the cause of our recent opioid epidemic, not doctors prescribing them. Yes, it was good that people got them out of their medicine cabinets and realized that their kids got a little potential danger. But as doctors have reduced their prescribing for opiates, the heroin addict with fentanyl in the drug has increased, actually. And of course, those drug overdoses are happening in younger people, not in the older group that uses more pain medication. So I don't know, that is a pretty complicated answer to your question. How did this all come about? There's a lot of history in it, but maybe that summarizes a little bit what most people understand has been happening in society.
I think that's a helpful understanding of how the problem may have evolved, began and evolved. I think the state we're at, what I'm curious about is, as you're treating patients, are there underlying biological factors where there's a predilection to addiction? That person has an addictive personality, and so you're screening for how you use these drugs with that person because they might be more apt to become an addict?
The answer to that question is it's not their personality, it's their genetics. Okay. So about 20% of people inherit the genetics. And then of those people, not all of them get exposed. Some of them are timid and don't use medicines, but the ones that do get exposed are at risk of addiction. So it's not your addictive personality, it's your addictive genetics.
So do we have a way to screen for those genetics? Is that possible at this point?
Actually, there are ways of screening for genetics, and sometimes we use it in medicine to determine how well a patient will respond to a certain drug. If they're a fast metabolizer, the drug goes through the system fast and they need a higher dose. If they're a slow metabolizer, they may need a lower dose. And so screening patients is done by physicians in their office when they have concerns about the patient's addiction. For opiate addiction, the simple thing is, if for any kind of addiction, is, you know, are you, is it in your family? Do you know it to be in your family? High risk or higher risk? Is it, are you a smoker? If you're a smoker, which used to be 25 or 30% of the population, recently it's coming down quite a bit because people are finally beginning to understand, you know, how dangerous smoking is. And the third question is, how often do you drink more than 3 drinks if you're a woman and 4 if you're a man? Women don't metabolize the drug as fast as men do and are a little more susceptible to its effects. So if you just ask those 3 questions, you can determine what a person's risk is. If the answer to all 3 of those is positive, then you have a patient that has significant risk. If the patient has ever had any addiction of any kind, been a smoker, they have the risk. So you ask them, have you had any problem with other drugs, any drug? So
okay.
There's also a questionnaire for alcohol called the CAGE questionnaire. You know, if you start drinking in the morning, how many drinks do you take? That questionnaire. But that answers your question about how doctors tend to screen for addictive problems.
Yeah, and okay, I'll just interject. It sounds like, Allison, maybe you weren't like a pain patient, but you were a recreational user of opiates and other kinds of drugs, and it just kind of escalated. And with that, maybe we'll continue on with your story.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, I was the perfect storm to become an addict. You know, I didn't know the time, of course, but I had a huge history of addiction in my family. And this is something I didn't find out until I was an adult. So yeah, I mean, I have a history of addiction on both sides of the family. And I have mental health issues, obviously, you know, depression, anxiety, you know, other things. And really, it becomes a way of self-medicating. You know, so many people don't want to go get help for their mental health issues for whatever reason. And they find ways to cope with it themselves. And I definitely did that. So yeah, I'm a college student. I've got a heroin habit the size of Texas. And, but I was functioning. I at that point I was a functioning addict. I can't say that I was happy, but as long as I was getting my schoolwork done and I was going to work and I was staying out of trouble, I just kept doing what I was doing. And I couldn't stop either. I mean, once you're addicted to heroin, it's really, really, really hard to stop unless there's actual medical intervention. I tried several times to stop on my own, and it never worked. It never worked. So I graduated college, got my first big girl job. And that's kind of when things became a nightmare, because that's when I really realized that I wasn't like other people. And I was really starting to hate my life and hate myself. And hate my addiction more than anything. You know, you go in on a Monday morning and everybody's standing around talking about what they did over the weekend, you know, talking about barbecues or, you know, new lawnmowers I had nothing to add to those conversations. You know, I couldn't be like, oh, you know, I chased drugs all weekend and all this and all that. I had nothing in common with these people at all. You know, they'd go out for lunch, invite me, and I would never go. I'd be in my office shooting up and then throwing up in the garbage can. It was really becoming a sad, sad scene. And that was also the time that I started trying to get off of it more on my own. And I don't know if a lot of people know, but heroin withdrawal is one of the worst things you can go through. You won't sleep for days, vomiting, chills, diarrhea. I mean, it's so sick. The only way to feel better is to do some heroin. And you can make that go away immediately. But you could just never get through the withdrawal. And I was starting to go into withdrawal so all the time that I started missing a lot of work. And my excuses for missing work had to get bigger and bigger and bigger. You know, I could say I had a cold. I could say I had strep throat. I could say I had the flu. And I mean, I thought I had people fooled, but I think people were starting to know something. Because we're getting so big, I was going to have to start saying things like I had malaria. I mean, they just weren't going to believe me anymore. So it got to a point where, you know, I was starting to realize that they were probably going to fire me. And I didn't want to go down like that. I didn't want to, you know.
Tell them about you got your job as a social worker.
Right. I was working in social work. And that was another problem. You know, I was being paid to judge people and being paid to help aid and like taking away people's children when I was no better. And that was starting to really kill me that I could sit there and do that. I just felt like I had no business doing that. And I had to take a really good long look in the mirror and I just couldn't stand it anymore. So I quit. I quit. I couldn't go on like that anymore. And that's really when my life story got really sad because here I am out of a job. I'm college educated. And where am I going to go work in that condition? You know, I mean, I was a full-blown drug addict. I had to spend almost all my time looking for drugs, obtaining drugs. I almost didn't even have time to work anymore. So that's when I started selling drugs. It kind of became the next natural step in, you know, where I was in my life. If I can't get a real job, well, what can I do? Well, I can sell drugs. And I did that for a long time and I hated it, but it was what it was. And it kept me high and kept drugs in my pocket and kept my rent paid. And then after some time, I was given an opportunity to stop selling drugs and I actually started trafficking drugs. I thought this person that I was working for was doing me a really big favor. When in fact, they weren't. I look back now and I was being used and I was being put in a line of danger. So this person didn't have to. And again, I was so hooked and so stupid, I just did it anyway. And so, yeah, I was running across state lines and, you know, shipping drugs back to Montana. And it was really dangerous and it was really scary. And I was put in some awful situations that I'll never forget. I've had a loaded gun put to my head, been around gang members. It was really awful. And I was really at a point where I didn't care whether I lived or died anymore. There were times where I just wish I would have gotten arrested because if I could get arrested, I'd get thrown in jail and then I would be forced to stop the drugs. I wouldn't have a choice. But that day never came. And luckily, I'm very lucky I never got caught. But the last trip I ever made, there was a breaking point, which finally made me want to quit. I was coming back from a trip and we had stopped in Spokane and there was this gal there that bought some heroin. She had just gotten out of prison that day. Sweet gal. She was in prison for like 5 years or something. And she got high and she dropped dead in front of me, overdosed in front of me, fell right over. And most people would react in a way where you'd be calling it, you know, an ambulance, try to help them, you know, be in a complete panic. I was totally inconvenienced by it. I just, you know, I looked at her and just said, God, get her out of here. And I, you know, driving home that night, it kind of occurred to me that I had done that. And I couldn't believe that I would view another person that way. And it really just set in that I was not okay. And I needed to get help. And I needed to get a heart back. And I needed to get my life back on track. And it was really scared me too. It really scared me to have somebody die in front of me. I don't really know if she died, but I wasn't gonna, we didn't stick around long to find out. But that was it for me. 2 weeks later, after that incident, I literally packed up all my stuff and I was gone and ended up in Sandpoint. I fled everything I knew. I fled the people I was working for. And I came to Sandpoint and went to a rapid detox program out in Detroit, Michigan. That's when they put you under anesthesia and suck all the drugs out of your body and you sleep through it. You sleep through the bad parts of it. Although it wasn't a good experience, but I'm glad I did it. And it got me sober enough to start living a normal life again and, you know, trying to get back on track. And it was during that time, shortly after rapid detox, I'd say about 6 months after I got to Sandpoint, I met Dr. Rust completely by chance. I was visiting an urgent care where he was working. He made a kind of a discovery about me, and he knew I was an addict and could tell I was an addict. And I remember initially being kind of mad. I remember kind of walking out going, what's this guy's problems? You know, what does he know about me? Well, he was right. He was right. You can't lie to this guy. He knew what I was up to. I was definitely struggling to stay sober at the time. A couple of weeks after that, and I went back to him. He'd given me information on his medical treatment, the Suboxone. And I sat on it for a couple of weeks. And I ended up calling him, and the rest is history. Here I am today, 16 years later, and never looked back. And things are wonderful now, and I don't ever have to live that way again. Now I just have the memories.
So it's been a pleasure taking care of Allison all these years. And when we first started out treatment, we thought that people just would be on this medicine for a few months and then take them off of it. It turned out that was not the case. It turned out that many needed them for a number of years to get into recovery. They needed the psychosocial part of recovery, which is NA, AA, and, you know, and positive things like journaling, things that keep you sober, okay? The drug was very helpful, but you also needed the psychosocial part of recovery. So at that point, when our patients did well and they were acting as sponsors 2 or 3 years later, we said, fine, wean off the drug. So we did wean patients off the drug at that time, but many of them had had multiple relapses like she did and were, you know, into this very seriously, not just a little bit recreationally. And so the effect was that gradually we kept our patients on medicine longer and longer. And now there are studies that show that people who come off the medicine have a higher rate of relapse years later compared to people who stay on it. And now we do recommend it because it's a lifelong disease. The medicine is safe, taken over long periods of time. We do recommend that people take it for basically for the rest of their lives. Some people still want to get off of it, but they have to maintain that psychosocial recovery so that they understand, hey, I have this disease. It's not my fault, but I have to take care of it the rest of my life. I don't get off easy. This is work.
So I have a question here. And first of all, I'd like to thank you, Allison, for sharing your very compelling story. And we're very grateful to hear of your recovery. And it's clear from not only your story, but from this conversation and others that there is a close association between addiction and mental health disease, which again is often stigmatized by us. And if not being triggered by depression and other forms of mental health issues, certainly the drug addiction then can create anxiety and other ones. And as you've gone through the physical treatments that Allison, you described, and Dr. Rust, you're talking about, would it be of interest to also look at how the patients deal with the underlying mental health issues, how those are treated, and can there be a successful recovery without also looking at that treatment?
Well, no, there is not usually successful treatment unless all aspects of your mental health are treated. If you have severe anxiety, panic attacks, for me, anxiety has always been the toughest thing to handle with patients. Antidepressants work great. Antipsychotics, if you have psychosis, if you're bipolar, they work great. But unfortunately, anxiety medicines, many of which have been the use and overuse of benzodiazepines like Valium and Xanax and Clonopin, have got people addicted. The people who continue these medicines seem to have even more anxiety sometimes. They get temporary relief with the medication. So anxiety is one of the toughest problems to treat in addiction medicine. And what happens is that you work with patients for 4 or 5 years who have anxiety and coexisting opiate use disorder, and it's a challenge. You know, getting those people to adequate counselors, or good counselors that understand both diseases and can help the patients manage their anxiety. So learning to manage the anxiety is a huge challenge and one of the biggest, because there's a 600-page book written by Ed Kansian, an addiction psychiatrist and psychotherapist. And in 600 pages, what you learn is very simply that people use to treat their own stress and anxiety. That's why people use, just like Allison when she was young and many other patients, just like people use pot. So getting them to get a handle on their anxiety, which has been a lifelong disease for almost everybody who has trouble with it, has been one of the bigger challenges for me in addiction medicine. And usually it involves them weaning off their addictive benzodiazepine drugs, which is a challenge in itself.
So we've heard about Allison's story. We've heard about all the challenges of addiction. And I'm hoping that you might be able to help us move forward as we come closer to the end of this interview and talk about noticing the signs in our family and friends, and then maybe some resources for where we might go to try and get them help.
especially when you look at me and like the things that I was doing, when people have a problem with addiction and you think it's a possibility, you look at things like, what they're spending their time doing. Are they spending less time at home? Are they hanging out with people that they didn't used to? Are they missing a lot of work? Are they missing a lot of school? Are they lying? Are they having continuing financial problems? There's a lot of signs out there that can point to that somebody might have a problem. And I'll tell you right now, it's most people won't come out and be like, I have a problem. It's usually friends and family that have to point that out, maybe like an intervention. And it's an unpleasant thing to do. Nobody wants to be sat down and be asked them if, if you have a problem. But that's usually what it comes to, is you have to look at somebody in the face and say, I get the sense, that you're hurting. Is there anything you want to talk about? It's getting people to open up. And that's not always an easy thing to do. But there's a lot of help in any community. There's a lot of help right in our own community. You know, if people have problems, you know, go to a trusted friend. Go to your pastor, your minister. You can see
your own family.
Your own family, yes, definitely. And you know, and you might get doors slammed in your face. I definitely got lots of doors slammed in my face. People were concerned, but they didn't always want to help, or they were mad or disgusted with you. But I always tell people, if you have a problem and you want to help, just keep trying. Keep asking for help, because you will find help in the most unlikeliest of places. There's lots of support groups. We have support groups for men. We have support groups for women, for teenagers. We even have support groups for people who have family members who are addicts. They're not addicts themselves, but it's a support group for people who know addicts.
That's called Naranon and Al-Anon.
And we have local chapters of them, yes? There's a, is it right in Crescent, the post office? Is that at the that one spot, Magnolia Center, or is it more than that one?
Well, there's meetings all over, and you can get a complete list, you know, online. But there's so many different NA groups, AA groups. There's groups going on literally every day. Every day you could find a meeting if you wanted to. And then of course there's recovery centers now, like Dr. Rust. There are, you know, medical offices that specialize in just treating addiction. And that's a great start. I mean, for someone to walk in and say, hey, I have a problem and I think you can help me. They'll get you in the right direction.
Tell us the contact info for your practice, Dr. Rust. I know you're about to retire, but you've got a replacement.
I do, but if you Google doctors who prescribe buprenorphine,
you
find a website by SAMHSA, S-H-A-M-S-H-A. It's a government website. And on that website, you'll find all the areas in the United States, cities, towns, in the list of the providers of buprenorphine in those towns. Okay, now there is, of course, OTPs or outpatient treatment centers that give methadone, which also works as well as buprenorphine. Before we had buprenorphine, our success rate with addiction was 10 to 15%, not good. Now it's 50%, either with methadone or with buprenorphine. Buprenorphine is a great pain medicine. 40% of my patients have pain associated with their addiction, chronic pain issues. And chronic pain is often what led to addiction. But at any rate, the buprenorphine is a wonderful medicine for chronic pain. And pain specialists here in town can prescribe it. There's four or five doctors here in town that can prescribe it, the Kinexu, Sandpoint Family Medicine. Even one of the OB ladies is a provider of buprenorphine. Getting people through pregnancies is a difficult task sometimes from people that are addicted and pregnant. So there's inpatient and hospital. KMC has an excellent inpatient. You mentioned Magnolia. And there's a male equivalent. I don't know its name, but there's a male equivalent that was just started by Fred, one of the local ministers, and their inpatient treatment centers. There is residential living centers in Coeur d'Alene has one. Oxford House is one. Hospital emergency rooms are a great place to go when you have an addiction problem, especially if you're withdrawal, and just be honest and tell them, hey, I got withdrawal or I was drinking too much. I need some help. You know, can you help me? So hospital emergency rooms are a great source. Treatment, medication assistance has changed today for all addicts in the last 30 years. Psychosocial treatment, NA and AA. Journaling, you know, is another way I treat patients. Let them take journals. Some people don't like to go to meetings with other people, so they can journal. And there are many sources online, Twitter, Facebook, YouTube has excellent videos on addiction. In the Rooms is another online addiction source. It's called In the Rooms. So there's many sources for treatment, but guidance like from one of the counseling agencies here in town, you know, TAMRAC, used to be Alliance, and now it's North Idaho Mental Health. There are many, and Kinigsu has Adam. He's a great counselor for people. Their doctor over there prescribes buprenorphine. So many resources in this community for help if you ask for it. The problem is your family sees you not asking for it.
I think that's a really good point. We have so many folks who live in our communities that are marginalized. They may not have families because they're older or they've moved or they're homeless. And so they don't have that support network. And if they're listening to this, or if you know someone listening to this, you can reach out to so many places for help in taking that first step. You don't have to know always exactly where it goes. It's just taking that first step and talking to someone and keeping an eye out for each other in the community, for those who are beyond our immediate families and friends, to the wider circles of people we come into contact with. That's about the only way we reach really those marginalized folks who aren't living in the mainstream.
Yeah. And as we come to a conclusion of this community conversation, do we have any final comments from Allison or Dr. Bob? And then we'll wrap it up.
Well, I think that it's important that, I mean, if we look at why we're here today, I think it's important to be able to talk about addiction comfortably. It's not a dirty word. And mental health isn't a dirty word. And I think if we can all just put that stigma aside and be able to say those words, I think we could have a lot more success in our own families and in our own lives and hopefully in the community.
As far as final comments, is we were hoping to get to a paper that says how to help someone close with addiction. So I have some copies of this, and basically the bottom line is don't yell them and tell them what a bad Adam and tell them what a bad person they are, how stupid they are to use drugs. You ask them questions. You know, that way they have to respond to your questions. You're not making statements about how terrible they are. You're trying to get them to answer, well, how long do you think this will go on in your life, or how much can this harm you, or, you know, do you think you'll get another DUI? It's asking questions. That's the basics of this. You know, you need to be calm and honest about the behavior, discuss the situation with somebody you trust, continue to include the person in family activities, explain addiction as an illness to the children in the family, contact Al-Anon or Naran, but don't punish, don't threaten, don't bribe, don't preach. Preaching is the hardest thing we have to restrain ourselves from doing. Don't cover up or make excuses or protect addiction people from the consequences of their behavior. Don't dump bottles of pills or destroy drugs. Don't try to argue or reason with somebody who's under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Don't drink or do drugs with the addicted person. Don't feel guilty or responsible for their behavior. If you're a teenager, don't drive with anybody under the influence of alcohol or drugs. Ask for their keys. So those are just a few things, but if they want to read this paper and hear it in a longer form, see it in a longer form, I'd be happy to share it.
Okay, and as we wrap up, how would they do that, Dr. Rust? How can folks reach out to you if they would like to get that information?
Well, I was going to give it to you.
Okay.
Which I will do. But
all right.
My phone number has always been available to patients. The new office number is the same as the old one, 208-263-1345.
Very good.
Then the new doctor's office is Dr. Whiting from Coeur d'Alene. He'll have copies of this that he can share.
Perfect. Well, all right, as we are wrapping up, and I would like to really thank you, Dr. Rust and Allison, for telling us your stories and sharing so much information.
It's very compelling. It's thank you for joining us. It's been a great show. Thank you.
It really has.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. This has been KRFY Community Conversations, talking with Dr. Bob Rust and Allison about substance abuse in the community and ways that we can get help for our friends and family and learn about it.
Thank you very much. This is another community conversation. Just a reminder, if you came in midway and want to hear the whole show, you can listen to our podcast at krfy.org.